Penguin Random House Audio presents The Go-Go Years, the drama and crashing finale of Wall Street's bullish 60s, by John Brooks, foreword by Michael Lewis, read for you by Johnny Heller. Foreword. This may be, conceivably, one of the last books to be written about Wall Street in its own time. Thus John Brooks concludes his famous portrait of Wall Street in the 1960s. Well, we all know what happened to that prediction. Books about Wall Street in its own time went forth and multiplied. You could fill a small library with the books about Wall Street that have been published since the Go-Go Years first appeared in 1973. In the past few years alone, I have seen manuscripts or outlines or proposals for books about Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, George Soros, Michael Steinhardt, and Michael Milken. These days, no book about money is considered too trivial or ill-conceived to publish. Brooks himself is partly to blame for this state of affairs. He was one of the first journalists to prove that an outsider could walk into Wall Street and emerge with a long and detailed story that a generally educated but specifically ignorant outsider could read with pleasure. The Go-Go Years is such a story. The tendency with books about Wall Street is to put them down with a reassuring sigh and say, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Or as Brooks would no doubt put it to his old New Yorker audience, plus on change, plus sur les mêmes choses. This book contains plenty in it to justify that response. As the stock market chart races to the roof, a cast of characters familiar to observers of the financial 1990s takes the stage. In 1960s Fidelity Mutual Fund guru Gerald Tsai, there are echoes of 1990s Fidelity Mutual Fund guru Jeff Vinnick. In the detached aloofness of the original hedge fund manager A.W. Jones, there is at least a trace of the detached aloofness of his successor, George Soros. In the money-grubbing of 1960s market man, there is an echo of the money-grubbing of the 1990s market man. In America, writes Brooks, with its deeply imprinted business ethic, no inherent stabilizer, moral or practical, is sufficiently strong in and of itself to support the turning away of new business when competitors are taking it in. As a people, we would rather face chaos making pots full of short-term money than maintain order and sanity by profiting less. But what is mainly interesting today for readers of John Brooks is how different the market of the 1990s feels from the market of the 1960s. There is no real equivalent, in Brooks's account, to the technology stocks of today, for instance. There are no foreign markets, no bonds, almost no computers. On the other hand, all those great white institutions that these days barely merit a mention in today's books on Wall Street, the SEC, the NYSE, the establishment, loom large in Brooks's account. Then there is the moral of the story, or stories. The Go-Go Years reduces fairly neatly to a series of morality tales about the most outlandish events of the 1960s. Ross Perot dropping $450 million in one day. Saul Steinberg having the nerve to consider, much less to attempt, a takeover of Chemical Bank. Eddie Gilbert seducing some rich people into investing in his ill-starred ventures before vanishing into Brazil with the other stock market losers. How tame they now all seem. At least to this reader, they have lost their ability to shock. The author clearly considers his subjects engaged in an endless cycle of falls and redemptions, but the modern reader is constantly having to remind himself who has fallen and why he needs to be redeemed. These are moralist tales in which the moral has at least in part been lost. This may help to explain the most curious thing about the Go-Go Years, its tone of voice. Those lovely, long, multipartite sentences, the glorious arch of the authorial eyebrow. Brooks's palpable feeling that you, gentle reader, are a broadly educated person who instinctively disapproves of these speculators. Brooks's voice is, above all, the voice of the old establishment. The reader Brooks imagines himself to be speaking to is the same shockable character who has vanished from the financial world over the past 30 years. Who on Wall Street these days thinks twice about speculation? Who disapproves of large corporate takeovers? No such person exists, or if he does, he's living on some island so remote that no word of the market will ever reach him. In the end, The Go-Go Years is not to be read in the usual manner of Wall Street classics. You do not read this book to see our present situations reenacted in the past, with only the names changed. You read it because it is a wonderful description of the way things were in a different time and place. If Brooks's sense that the end of the old establishment would mean the end of Wall Street led him occasionally to get things wrong, at least he got them wrong in an interesting way. Wall Street, as a social context, is apparently doomed not by reform, but by mechanization, he wrote toward the end of the book. Already in the early 1970s, a significant proportion of stock trading is being conducted not face-to-face on the floor under a skylight, but between men sitting in front of closed-circuit television screens in offices hundreds or thousands of miles apart. Wall Street is heading toward transforming itself into an impersonal national slot machine, presumably fairer to the investor, but of much less interest as a microcosm of America. The description was dead on, but the forecast could not have been more wrong. In a mere 25 years, Wall Street has become the largest microcosm on Earth. Michael Lewis. Chapter 1. Climax. 1. On April 22, 1970, Henry Ross Perot of Dallas, Texas, one of the half-dozen richest men in the United States, was so new to wealth at 40 that he was not listed in Poor's Register and had just appeared for the first time in Who's Who in America. Only a small fraction of his fellow countrymen had ever heard of him. Many who had met him by happening to sit next to him on airliners had not found him particularly impressive or interesting. Barely 5.5 feet tall, with a naive, straightforward gaze, an unamused smile, a crooked nose, a hillbilly East Texas accent, and a short crew cut, tended like a tennis lawn, he was inclined to talk at length and with enthusiasm about things like patriotism and the Boy Scouts of America. More than anything else, he seemed to be a nice, promising young man who was probably selling something. Yet that day, Perot made a landmark in the financial history of the United States and perhaps of the Western world. It was hardly a landmark to be envied, but it was certainly one to be remembered. That day, he suffered a paper stock market loss of about $450 million. He still had, on paper, almost $1 billion left afterward. But that wasn't the point. The point was that his one-day loss amounted to more than the total assets of any charitable foundation in the country after the top five, more than the annual welfare budget of any city except New York, and more not just in figures, but in actual purchasing power than J. Pierpont Morgan was known to be worth at the time of his death in 1913. It was also, quite possibly, more in actual purchasing power than any man had ever lost in a single day since the Industrial Revolution brought large private accumulations of money into being. 2. It was Earth Day. The environment had recently become a national mania, especially among the young, and a group of conservationist leaders, headed by Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, had picked April 22 as a day of national dedication to the cause of eliminating pollution in all its forms. Were preposterously large paper stock market profits such as Ross Perot had made to be considered a form of pollution? Quite possibly. In Washington, in front of the Department of the Interior building, 1,200 young people milled around shouting, "Off the oil and stop the muck," to protest government leases to oil producers, whose operations were thought to cause pollution. There were anti-pollution rallies of 25,000 or more, watched by the FBI, it became known later, in New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia. In Bloomington, Minnesota, former Vice President Humphrey urged the United Nations to establish an environmental agency to combat pollution around the world. And at Georgetown University in Washington, Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana called for a national agency to conquer pollution as we have conquered space. Interior Secretary Walter Hick.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?